Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ralph Wilkinson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Maurice Williams. I'm asking that Mr. Williams' conviction be reversed on the following two grounds. That first of all, the trial court denied Mr. Williams his right to proceed pro se after the trial had commenced. And second of all, that the trial court wrongfully denied Mr. Williams the opportunity to present a defense of justification and choice of evils during the course of his trial. The trial court violated Mr. Williams' right to represent himself pursuant to the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 7 of the Delaware Constitution. Mr. Williams, through his attorney, made it explicitly clear that he wanted to represent himself in the middle of the trial after three of four of the state's witnesses had testified. And the trial court immediately denied Mr. Williams his request to proceed pro se. The trial court never engaged in a colloquy with Mr. Williams. When Mr. Williams made his request, the trial court immediately stated, he's not allowed to. We're moving forward. You don't get to change your mind in the middle of trial. I know what he's trying to accomplish, and it's not going to happen.
Now, how far along was the case at this point?
The state had called four witnesses, and this was after the third state's witness had testified.
So three, basically 75% of the state's case.
Yes, Your Honor. Presented.
What's the test you believe should apply to the trial court or the trial judge's analysis?
Well, it's clear that the case of Christopher versus State that this court decided that the trial judge should have inquired of Mr. Williams whether there was a valid waiver of his right to counsel, and if there was a valid waiver of the right to counsel, the trial court should have considered does the resulting prejudice from having the defendant proceed pro se outweigh his right to proceed pro se. There should be a balancing test done.
So your position is rather than just summarily dismissing the request, the judge should have excused the jury for 10 or 15 minutes and made a record of why he wanted to proceed pro se, and if the judge was convinced it was a legitimate request, whether he understood the adverse implications for him mm-hmm. of making that decision.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe they should have went through the Hartman test. Did he make a valid and voluntary knowing waiver? And then the judge should have considered, well, how disruptive would this be to the trial, and consider that. But there was no consideration.
Let's think in terms of two prongs. Mm-hmm. The first being the understanding of the consequences of going pro se and the knowing, willing, voluntary waiver of the right to counsel, which you clearly already had implemented. Just assume, as a matter of fact, that's the case. Why can't this case be decided on the second prong, that it's obvious to anyone that at this stage of the proceedings it would be hugely disruptive to have him proceed representing himself, even if he fully understood the consequences of doing so? And I ask you that question in this context. Is this a drop-dead two-prong test that technically you must answer those questions? Or can we assume that the first prong would have been met and focus on the second prong as the trial judge apparently did?
I believe he should at least be given the consideration to go forward. I guess the second prong doesn't come into play unless the first prong is met. But even in the second prong, Your Honor, I don't think it's plainly obvious it would have been hugely disruptive.
Well, I use that phrase not because that's what I think. I use that phrase because it's apparent to me that's what the trial judge thought. That, as Justice Ridge just pointed out, 75% of the state's case has been presented, a jury's been impaneled, getting ready to wrap up the state's case. There's counsel there that's prepared whatever defense he wants to present. It causes problems about, well, now that he represents himself, is he going to want to call different witnesses than counsel had chosen to call? Is he now going to turn perhaps from not testifying to testifying, and what the consequences may be for that? And you've got a jury sitting there, and you're almost close to half of the case over. Why isn't that dysfunctionally disruptive?
I think it's important to note here that when the trial court made its decision, it never consulted with the state to ask their position on this matter, how disruptive it would be. And I think the balancing test goes to how disruptive it is to the government or the state. And I think the state would be in the best position to say, to give an answer as to how disruptive it would be. And the state was never consulted in this. The trial judge immediately gave her decision without asking any questions of the state or getting their position. And the state is would be in the prime position to know how disruptive it would be.
Well, the prosecutor could have stood up and said, well, Your Honor, before we go down that road, there are two issues that have to be addressed in order to preserve this trial. The first is voluntariness. The second is the consequences of representing himself and the risk of disrupting the proceedings. Either defense counsel or the state, we assume, knows the law. They didn't raise an issue.
When Mr. Williams' request was made through counsel to represent himself, as is from the transcripts, the trial judge immediately stated her its answer, and it was quite clear when it stated he's not allowed to, we're moving forward, that there was no more room for discussion with the trial court when it made its decision.
Well, you're not suggesting the trial judge said, I don't want to hear from either one of you on this.
You're
telling me that counsel's so intimidated that they can't say, well, Your Honor, let me call to your attention, State, the case of Christopher versus State, let me call to your attention the methodology that the Delaware Supreme Court has suggested should be used when a defendant wishes to represent himself, particularly in light of the fact he already has counsel and this case has proceeded as far as it has. You suggesting that they couldn't stand up and make that comment?
No, Your Honor, it was a matter of intimidation, but it was, as transcripts show, that where version being argumentative, it came off argumentative with the judge, and counsel does not usually argue with the judge when she makes a clear ruling in her mind the way it was stated. It was clear that the trial court had made up its mind already.
Okay.
And stated that, you know, even see we're moving forward, and that it wasn't a context where the trial court was going to deliberate anymore on this matter.
Well, can you tell us how it would not have been disruptive to allow the defendant to proceed pro se at this stage of the proceeding?
In one context, since most of the state's case was over, I think that kind of tends to lead to be less disruptive than if the defendant had wanted to go pro se earlier into the case. So a lot of the trial, 75% of the state's case was done, and I think that goes to being less disruptive since he made the request later in the trial. And it goes back to, for the trial court to really weigh how disruptive it would be, I think there needs to be input from the state, because the prejudice that the court concerns itself with is how disruptive it is to the government, and the state was never consulted in this case.
So your point is, indeed, they were pretty much ready for the defense, and the question for your client was he going to present the defense pro se, or was his lawyer going to present the defense?
Pretty much so, because there was only one more state's witness. So.
Do we have any basis in the record to infer whether it would have been any different with or without a lawyer? The defense, that is.
No, Your Honor, I don't. There's nothing that can be inferred from the record that would know whether the defense would have been different or not.
Is this a structural defect of the kind that precludes a plain error analysis or a harmless error analysis?
No, Your Honor, I don't. It's not a harmless error. It's an issue of de novo. It's a fundamental right to be able to proceed pro se. And Mr. Williams is arguing his right was violated, that there was no consideration, there was no colloquy done. It's important if you turn to the Christopher versus State, this court held that the colloquy between the trial court and the defendant was inadequate. However, Mr. Christopher's conviction was upheld because Mr. Christopher later said that he was happy with counsel, he was okay with counsel. So in Mr. Williams' case, there was absolutely no colloquy at all with Mr. Williams. And by allowing Mr. Williams' conviction to stand, it would make the Christopher case almost like superfluous, because if Mr. Christopher's colloquy is inadequate and had concern in this case here, there was no colloquy.
Did the trial judge accurately state the law when she said you don't get to change your mind in the middle of the trial?
No, Your Honor. I believe that when she made her immediate decision without any colloquy, it's easy to infer from her statement that she believed that as soon as the trial started, that it was automatic that the defendant could not proceed pro se. And under the court's ruling in Christopher, that is not the law. There still has to be consideration given to, you know, can he validly waive his right to counsel, and then the balancing act between the prejudice resulting from that. The second reason Mr. Williams' conviction should be overturned is because the trial court erred by not allowing Mr. Williams to present a justification defense, choice of evils, or justification. Mr. Williams wanted to argue that he walked off from the Plummer Center. He was given a pass earlier in the morning and never returned, and he wanted to find his daughter to intervene because he believed his daughter was going to commit suicide. And the trial court, immediately upon hearing about this prior to trial, that the defense wanted to pursue the justification choice of evils, the trial court denied Mr. Williams' request to be able to present this defense.
When you say the trial judge heard about it, but there was a motion in limine, either oral or written, wasn't there, from the state to preclude him from offering that testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. The state had offered on the day of the trial motion in limine to preclude any defense of that nature.
So it wasn't, she just heard about it. She had an actual motion before on which she had to rule.
Yes, sir. You're correct. And she immediately, the trial court immediately stated, I'm not going to allow it, okay? I'm just not. It's just wrong. In my bones, I know it's wrong. And we're asking, when the trial court denied Mr. Williams the right to pursue this defense, she relied on the Johnson-Loverkamp decision of the five factors when there's an escape.
She did rely on more than what was in her bones.
Actually, at the time she initially stated, I know in my bones it's wrong. At lunch, I'm going to find the case law and then back up my decision.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we weren't left with the idea that all she relied upon was intuition.
No,
she
you're
actually looked up the case law.
Yes. Initially, she did rule based on with her intuition, and later on she came back. There was discussion of the Johnson-Loverkamp.
Well, and in your brief, you try to distinguish Johnson, and there's certainly distinguishing aspects, but if you look at the fifth part of the Johnson test, when you are in a safe place, you're supposed to contact the authorities immediately. And in this particular case, your client absconded and didn't contact anybody for 7 or 8 days. So if there had been an exchange on the record, your client wouldn't have been able to overcome the fact that even if he was justified in leaving, he didn't meet the requirement that as soon as he was secure, he needed to tell people, here I am.
Your Honor, he was never given that opportunity. He was never questioned about this. And
Well, I know that, but my point is, it's undisputed he was gone for 8 days, right?
Yes, sir.
And he didn't contact anybody for 8 days.
That's correct.
So he'd have to have two great explanations. First, I'm justified in escaping, and second, I'm justified in not telling anybody where I am for 8 days, notwithstanding the fact that I'm in a secure place by applying Johnson. But my question is, even if you want to distinguish Johnson, how was he ever going to satisfy the fifth element?
I think that would be up. He should have had the opportunity to present that to a jury, and that should be that's a factual question that should be left to the province of the jury to decide.
But what was the proffer? Was there a proffer?
The proffer was the defendant was going to testify at trial that he had to concern his daughter was going to commit suicide and he had to intervene, and through cross-examination of some of the state's witnesses, that he had made his concern verbally known to at least one of the witnesses, that he had a concern for his daughter. And I would argue this, his testimony, regardless of how credible the trial court might believe it to be, is still enough to allow him to offer this to the jury,
I understand that was your argument, and if we assume his daughter might have committed suicide and he was, we'll say, quote, justified in going to try to save her life, my question is, how can he explain not notifying the authorities for 8 days?
I believe that is a question left for the jury for him to give an explanation. If he had been given the opportunity to testify at trial, he could have given an explanation, whether it's a credible explanation
but
of not notifying
proffered.
It.
None was proffered on the 8-day absence.
No, that specific, the fifth factor was not asked about in the proffer.
This choice of evils, is it a defense or an affirmative defense?
It's an affirmative defense, I believe.
Does it, the statute that creates the affirmative defense, speak to any of this gloss that Johnson attempts to put on choice of evils in an escape context?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
I'll try. Does the choice of evils statute itself include the gloss that Johnson attempts to put on choice of evils as an affirmative defense in the context of escape from custody? Let me ask it a different way.
Where does Johnson
come off modifying the statute?
I think that is an issue, Your Honor, because the five factors are real there are five factors that deal with a factual circumstance.
The General Assembly has never qualified choice of evils application in these escape contexts, correct?
Yes, sir. And that's one. I'm arguing Mr. Williams' case falls outside of Johnson, but I also believe, too, that the five factors laid out in Johnson was not instigated by the legislature. So it's outside. That's why I think Mr. Williams should
have. What's our authority to put that gloss on choice of evils? How do we add five conditions to the choice of evils affirmative defenses availability to a defendant out of whole cloth? From where does our authority come?
I think there's an argument to be made that
I'm not asking you to advocate that argument, but do you know of any source of authority that would allow this court to modify the choice of evils affirmative defense language and make it applicable solely to an escape context?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, if you're driving your car at 80 miles an hour to take a pregnant partner or spouse to the hospital because they're about to have a baby, is there a gloss that says you must call the hospital ahead and let them know that you're speeding to get there because your wife's about to have a baby in the backseat of your car? Could we write that gloss onto the choice of evils defense?
I would argue that the court would not. That would be a legislative in terms of factual specific.
But how do we do it in escape?
I don't know the basis for putting a factual.
Okay, you have a minute left. Did you want to save it for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Timothy Donovan representing the state. If it please the court, I'll address these issues in the same order as my colleague, Mr. Wilkinson. The first of all is the denial of the right to proceed pro se. There is, of course, the lack of the probing and searching colloquy, which has two purposes, as this court has pointed out numerous times. First, to advise, to make sure the defendant is validly waiving the right to counsel, because the proceeding pro se necessarily entails the waiver of an important constitutional right, the right to counsel. And two, to ensure that the defendant understands completely the responsibilities and the perils of proceeding pro se. And certainly in a case where the judge permits the defendant to proceed pro se, that is the opposite of this case here, the failure of the court to engage in either one of those parts of those colloquies, to either obtain a valid waiver to the right to counsel or to advise the defendant of his responsibilities and the perils of proceeding pro se, are going to be fatal. They are. I mean, there's no way around that. In the case, however, where the court, as here, simply denied out of hand that the permission to proceed pro se, well, there's been no waiver of the right to counsel. He wasn't permitted to waive the right way to write the counsel. And there's certainly no problem with the failing to advise of responsibilities and perils to proceed pro se because he wasn't allowed to proceed pro se. The problem, as I see it in this case, is the trial judge's failure to articulate the reasons that she simply denied out of hand the defendant's request. And I have argued in my brief, and I will continue to argue now, that following as it did immediately upon the judge's final decision on the justification defense, this was an attempt by the defendant, and I think it's very clear from the judge. First of all, the judge articulated two reasons. One, of course, was the timing. I mean, when she said at the bottom of page 75, of the transcript, A25 in the appendix, you don't get to change your mind in the middle of trial. And as my colleague noted, three or four state witnesses had testified, and this was the middle of trial.
Well, is that the law, an accurate statement of the law?
That is, as a matter of a bright line rule, no, it is not. Generally, a defendant who requests proceed pro se in advance of trial, there is really, once the colloquy is accomplished, there is really nothing the court can do to refuse the request. Quite honestly, if the defendant asked to go pro se, say at arraignment or a week before trial, the court can only engage in the colloquy and grant the request. On the morning of trial, now, there are certain other factors the court must weigh. And the courts look disfavorably upon these last-minute attempts, especially if they're accompanied by a request for a continuance in order to prepare for trial. When the request comes in the middle of trial, then the balance shifts, and the court has other things to consider, and the request to proceed pro se, my experience is generally outweighed by the timing of the request. In this case, it's very clear, I think, as a second reason, that the judge did not consider this a genuine request to proceed pro se. Immediately, in rapid fashion, the court denied, finally, the justification defense, followed immediately by Mr. Wilkinson saying he wants another lawyer, which, of course, the judge said, no, I'm not going to give you another lawyer. You're going to go with this one. And then Mr. Wilkinson standing up said, now he wants to proceed pro se. And that's when the judge said, I have been top of page 76, again, A25. I understand what he's trying to accomplish, and it's not going to happen. That is, he's trying to either provoke a mistrial or create reversible error. And the judge said it's not going to happen. Now,
It may have actually happened.
We don't know that for sure yet, but it's certainly a possibility. But I'm sure the court is well aware that the invocation of Faretta rights is occasionally used by defendants for these purposes, and the judge here felt that that was the case. I certainly wish the judge had articulated her reasons for this in about the middle of page 75, again, A25, the court mentioned, he's been this route before. Obviously, the judge is privy to some knowledge. Unfortunately, the judge did not put on the record what that knowledge was so that this court could review it. So I have, of course, in my brief, and again, I have a fallback position based on Christopher, the fact that Mr. Wilkinson continues to represent Mr. Williams on appeal as an indication that Mr. Williams is satisfied with Mr. Wilkinson's representation. He has made no request either to discharge Mr. Wilkinson and obtain another attorney, nor has he made a request to proceed pro se on appeal. I realize that's not quite the same as Christopher, where there was an express indication by the defendant during trial that he was now satisfied with his attorney's performance. But even though this is not expressed, I think the defendant's actions here, or lack of action on appeal, speaks volumes. And again, to summarize the state's position here is that the lack of the probing, searching colloquy, there should have been one, but the fact that the defendant was not allowed to proceed pro se does not make that fatal, and that I should hope there is enough here, context here, to satisfy the court that the trial judge's apparent decision that this request to proceed pro se was not a genuine one, that was not made for legitimate reasons.
If the trial judge had asked the prosecutor about, is this disruptive or would this be disruptive, would the state have had a response?
We had one more witness, and I don't see that this would have changed that at all. It would have been certainly disruptive if the defendant had asked for some time to prepare a case, and obviously if it asked for a continuance, a mistrial to continuance, that would have been highly disruptive. We never got that far. But the state's case would proceed apace. The problem may have arisen during closing argument when the defendant tried to get his defense in, the defense that the judge had told him he could not present. But other than that, I can't articulate any other possible disruption. It certainly would have been prejudicial to the defendant. All of a sudden, have him pop up in front of the jury, and now he's representing himself, doing the cross-examination and the closing argument. So I think that's why these mid-trial switching of horses from trial counsel to pro se are frowned upon, or certainly frowned upon. Not just disruption to the court, but quite frankly, prejudice to the defense, though.
Can we take judicial notice of experience from other cases and perhaps from our own work as attorneys and as trial judges that it's difficult for an individual to represent themselves and for a trial judge to manage the case when a defendant's operating pro se and to explain to the jury why there's been this sudden change in the process in a way that doesn't raise questions that no one knows how they might be articulated or how they might be answered outside of comments the trial judge has to make to the jury?
The only answer I have to that is certainly.
We've seen situations where defendants want to testify in a narrative, and it brings in, without an opportunity to block it from the jury, information that otherwise would not have been allowed after a question is asked that might elicit that information and an objection is raised. That alone is disruptive, isn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor. No, it's certainly disruptive in all the ways that Your Honor has pointed out. So to move to the justification, the court did mention and I think I emphasized in my brief, that critical final Lubberkamp factor, Johnson-Lubberkamp factor, that is, the surrendering of oneself. And even in common law, and I think Lubberkamp mentions an older Delaware case, Davy Palmer, that surrendering oneself was a critical factor. Once the emergency situation has ended, the defendant has a duty, if he's going to raise his defense of justification at that point, to notify the authorities or to surrender himself. And I think the reasoning behind that is that the defendant may be entirely justified in the initial escape. Maybe the prison's on fire. Well, just stick with the prison's on fire. And the defendant runs out of the prison. Fine. Once he's in a position of safety, has escaped the fire, the defendant says, well, I was justified in escaping. I think I will stay in escape status. I think I'll leave the scene. I think I'll go away. I think I'll go to Elkton, Maryland. Well, once he has made that decision outside, the initial breaking through the prison walls or whatever is justified. But what's not justified, and where the defense ends, is when the defendant decides to, in a sense, escape a second time and not go back.
Well, is the ultimate issue here whether those circumstances are a jury question, because they're a question of fact, or whether a judge can bar the presentation of the affirmative defense absolutely based on the fact that those circumstances may exist?
This court, in Johnson, this court did address that it is within the judge's discretion to ask for a proffer before allowing the defense to be presented. Now, of course, it's also within the trial judge's discretion to allow the defense to go forward and then to either grant or deny the instruction. But in Johnson, it was the judge asked for a proffer and then denied it. And the reason, as this court pointed out in Johnson, was that the judge also has to make relevancy determinations and also 403 determinations. And if the judge determines ahead of time that this evidence is not relevant, and in this case, the lack of surrendering oneself, which is a very it's essential either today in the view of Leverkamp or at common law, this would mean that any testimony that was presented would not justify the justification or choice of evils instruction. So this would be under 403, one of the factors is simply a waste of time. So the judge had decided that since the evidence would not accomplish what the defendant wanted, since there was that critical factor missing, then...
I take your point that that's what the case law says. But does it appear anywhere in the statute?
As the choice of evil statute, no. The choice of evil statute is a general one relating to any particular situation and not specifically to prison breaks. The prison break body of law antedates the statute and goes back.
And why doesn't the statute abrogate the common law?
Well, it could be. My friend, Mr. Wilkinson, talked about it as a choice of evils. I'm talking about it as a justification. I'm not sure exactly where it falls, but the choice of evils is general enough to encompass it. But again, I'm saying that the choice of evils is a very broad statute that must apply to all situations, and it's then the position of the court then to talk about what is necessary to establish the defense in specific situations. And here the court has reached back into the body of common law to determine that it was must be the emergency situation justifying the breaking out to begin with, the leaving to begin with, and the necessity of once the danger has passed or once the reason has been accomplished for breaking out, then the defendant, and this is critical, the defendant has the duty to surrender himself or to notify the authorities where he is so they can come and get him. And that did not happen here. And this is the various factors that this court has applied to this choice of evils defense to apply to the specific prison break situation.
Well, he had permission to leave the Plumber Center, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
He had permission to leave the Plumber Center, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. He had permission to leave, and he was to be back.
He just didn't return when he was supposed to.
He had to go to some counseling, and he was supposed to be back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he did not arrive, and then they started looking for him and eventually found him living with a relative in Elkton, Maryland. I think it was 8 days later. If the court has no further questions, I have nothing else to say.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I think this case is different than Christopher, and turning to the point that that the state made, that I'm continuing to represent Mr. Williams in the appeal. It's a different proceeding. I would argue that the appeal is a different proceeding than the trial, and it would make sense for a defendant to want to go pro se during a trial, but there's also a different skill set to do an appeal, and a defendant may not want to go pro se during appeal, but would want to go pro se during the trial. So that does not negate his prior request to go pro se during the trial. I think Mr. Williams would concede that after trial has commenced, that the burden for a defendant to go pro se becomes a little bit higher than as opposed to a defendant asking to proceed per se prior to the trial. However, the trial court still has to go through a reasoning process and a colloquy with the defendant to see if he wants to have a valid waiver and how disruptive it would be. And the trial court's decision should be based on clear findings and a logical reasoning here. And in the matter of Mr. Williams, there were no clear findings made when the trial court immediately denied Mr. Williams' request to go pro se.
Thank you. Okay. Counsel, before you leave us, Mr. Donovan, would you rise for a moment? We'd like to take this opportunity, understanding that you retire from state service and the Department of Justice on Friday, to express for all the members of the court, not just the three who are here today. We've talked about this, so I'm cleared to represent everyone in these remarks, how much we appreciate your professionalism, your ethical standards, your preparation before you came before us these many, many years to represent the state and the people of Delaware in the appellate forum. The term officer of the court is something that we take very seriously. You epitomize all the good qualities of an officer of the court. We are happy for you that you've reached the point where you can retire. We're unhappy that you've made the decision to retire. We have to get over it. Happily, you can move forward without worrying about your absence from this courtroom. But we genuinely believe that you've made a significant positive contribution to the development of the criminal law in this state. Your Department of Justice should be proud of your service. So should your family, friends, and the entire community. Thank you so much for what you've done for all of us. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Rise.